Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Today is Tuesday, March 19th, and it is 1:31 p.m. With me today are Senator Costello, the Vice Chair. We also have Senator Gray Jackson, and also thank you, Senator Bishop. I know you have a really busy schedule with finance, so thank you all for being here. Of course, myself, Chair Reinbold. Please disable your electronic devices because it does interfere with the equipment. Thanks, Natasha, for pulling this together, as usual. And Nancy, your great work. We really appreciate you. And Eileen, thanks for operating LIO operator today. I know that it's going to be kind of busy with that today. So today we have a very busy committee. First, we're going to be hearing from Charles Silver and David Hyman on the cost of health care and the idea how we might address the issue. And they're going to have about 10 minutes and then about 5 minutes for questions and answers. We are going to interrupt the meeting at 2:30 today because we have lots of appointees that we have to deal with, but Julie Duquette from the Workers' Compensation, she needs to be right on at 2:30. A lot of our appointees have very busy schedules, so in order for them to get them to call in during the day, we make arrangements to make sure that we're very efficient. In regards to, we've got two of the governor's bills up today as well. We've got Senate Bill 65, Department of Labor technical ed programs, and we're going to be hearing also on Senate Bill 66 relating to the Department of Labor and Workforce Development and Workers' Compensation. So thank you, Commissioner Ledbetter. We appreciate you being here today. With that, we're going to go ahead and get started. If you gentlemen could just your names, and every time you speak, if you could make sure, because when there's two men, the recorder has a tough time. So just when you speak, name, affiliation, and then please proceed. Thank you.
I'm Charles Silver. I'm a professor at the University of Texas at Austin in the law school. I'm also an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute, and I'm one of the co-authors of Overcharge, which is the book that is seated there. And it's a soup to nuts examination of the healthcare system and the pathologies of the same.
And I'm David Hyman. I'm a professor at Georgetown University Law Center. I'm also an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute and the American Enterprise Institute, I am the other co-author of the same book, which if you don't have a copy, we'll be happy to make copies available to you or your staff for free. And I should note that we're not being compensated for being here in Alaska. The Pacific Health Coalition has paid our travel expenses, but we're not receiving any money. And we jumped at the opportunity to visit your beautiful state. Probably would have come without having our travel expenses covered, although don't tell PHC that.
And speaking of that, I don't know if we're allowed to receive books or not, but as long as Epix is good, I don't know if there's rules for $15 or not, but we'll talk about that later. We'll make sure we follow all the policies and procedures for that, because it's pretty tight right now.
Well, we don't make any money off the book either. In fact, it's a very significant money-losing proposition, if you want to know the truth. We're here at your disposal. We're not here representing anybody else. We're just here to give you the benefit of what we've learned about the healthcare system. So we're happy to answer any questions that you might have. I can give you a sort of brief overview of the book, obviously without a lot of the details. We have a system that acts as though it was designed to be expensive. The system is one in which third-party payers, insurance companies, Medicare, Medicaid, TRICARE, other entities, dominate the payment system. So at the point of delivery, patients typically pay about 11 cents on the dollar for health care. The rest, the 89 cents that is the bulk of the money, is coming from some third-party payer. And when you have a situation that is arranged like that, you reduce the incentive that the patients have at the point of delivery to ask hard questions about what the value of the service is and whether the price is reasonable, and you rely on the payers to do a lot of the work. And of course, you're creating a principal-agent relationship between the providers and the payers rather than between the providers and the patients. So when 89 cents on the dollar is coming from the payers, the providers are more concerned about satisfying whatever the requirements are that the payers have for delivering treatment rather than what's in the best interests of the patients. And so if the providers don't care that much about the prices, then the, if the payers don't care that much about the prices, then the providers don't either. And what we have is a system in which that is largely the case. It's a system in which the individuals are incentivized to overconsume, not to care so much about the prices. The providers are happy with that arrangement because it increases the flow of money to them. And the payers don't mind because they're structured to pay the bills. And in the case of private insurers, they often make their money on the basis of the dollar value of the claims that they pay. So the more they pay out, the more they make. And the government payers are just designed to pay the bills. They're not actually capable of scrutinizing the individual interactions between providers and patients. They're not there when the services are delivered. They don't know what the medical condition of the patient was. They don't know whether the service was appropriate or indeed even whether it was delivered. They simply receive electronic forms, and then if the fields are filled in properly, they pay the forms. And so we have a spiral of spending that has gotten us to the situation where we are today. I gather it's especially bad here in Alaska because your costs per patient are the highest, or spending per capita is the highest in the United States, which makes it the highest in the world because we're the most expensive country of all. So you guys are kind of at the unfortunate leading end of this problem. But it's a generic problem that exists everywhere. The whole country is caught up in it. So let me ask David to continue.
Yeah, so I agree with everything that this is Professor Hyman. I agree with everything that was just said. I would add a couple of quick observations. The first is that there are lots of fine, conscientious, hardworking people that work for insurers and that are healthcare providers. But the incentives that are created that they operate under often interfere with their using their best judgment on behalf of their patients, which is how we rely on things in much of the rest of the economy, and it works out reasonably well. We have a bad apple problem in other sectors of the economy, but we deal with that as they occur. Here there are incentives for overutilization of some services, underutilization of other services, not nearly enough attention to consistently delivering high-quality, high-value care. So that's one complication. The second is you see these sorts of incentive problems playing out in a variety of areas, including surprise medical bills or balanced billing. This is an issue in many states. It's an issue for patients who go to an in-network hospital but discover that the emergency department physicians are out of network, or go to an in-network hospital for surgery by an in-network surgeon and then discover the anesthesiologist is out of network. And when I say discover, they discover when they get a bill 3 to 6 months later that's unexpected, often at a very high dollar number, and their insurer declines to pay the face value. And then the patient is balance billed, and then there's a fight between them. And there's, you know, a complicated issue as to how to address that problem. I actually have a white paper that's coming out tomorrow that talks about this. I will note that many states are struggling with this issue, and I gather Alaska has basically a rule on the books about which there's certain unhappiness. I'm happy to talk about my own thoughts on that if there are questions. The other issue I wanted to flag is the importance of competition and market entry as a way of lowering prices and enhancing quality and value for patients. Restrictions on market entry, whether the result of a certificate of need arrangement, which many states, including Alaska, have, licensure requirements and scope of practice requirements, where Alaska is actually ahead of some other states with regard to scope of practice, and market consolidation more broadly, which is a challenge in Alaska for all sorts of obvious reasons, make it hard to have effective competition. And if you want to take steps to improve the performance of your healthcare system, both on price and quality slash value, that's where we think you should direct your attention, to encouraging market entry and using insurance for true catastrophes rather than the way we currently use it, which is for everything from soup to nuts. So with that, I think we've used 10 minutes, and I will stop.
Senator Ray Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had the privilege of attending the Lunch and Learn that these two gentlemen presented, and it was like almost 15 minutes, and it was really, really a great presentation, and I want to take this opportunity, if I may, Madam Chair, to just say thank you to both of them, because it was really one of the best.
Well,
thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Costello.
Thank you, and appreciate you being here in the Labor and Commerce Committee. When I served in the House, on the House Finance Committee, we had a lot of discussion about transparency and the lack of transparency, and we kind of highlighted that and shone a light on it, thinking that that would help address the situation. We've had several bills that have gone through the process where we learned that it's not so easy for companies to be transparent because they negotiate prices that are different depending on who you are. So it kind of defies logic where you go into a grocery store and you see that this item has this price, but in the medical environment, it depends on, you know, your insurance, and that's really frustrating for the consumer. And in your introductory remarks, you indicated that perhaps the focus needs to be on patients being educated and asking questions. My family's actually tried to do that, where you go into the doctor's office and you say, okay, I'd like to know when this goes from a level one to level two, or, you know, call in advance and ask for a possible price, and it's virtually impossible. I actually think there's a culture of lack of transparency where the providers are not accustomed to having that type of questioning going on because of the nature of the issue, meaning, you know, your health or your child's health. And so how do we change that so that providers are even aware of what's happening in their offices? I mean, they seem to be absent of that awareness, and then you leave that environment and you walk over to billing, and there's a whole new architecture and apparatus set up to deal with that. And I'm just, you know, healthcare costs are what's driving the budget up. It's what drives our school district budgets up. It's kind of the monster that's engulfing every single department and issue that we face, and yet we've been unable to really make headway in this area. So I appreciate you being here, and if any thoughts on that would be great.
Thank you for the question, Senator Costello, through the chair. We have a lot of stuff in the book on that, and one of the things I would say up front is that there are parts of the healthcare sector where there is a good deal of transparency. So I don't know if there's a walk-in medical clinic here in Juneau, but in a walk-in clinic, one can literally walk in, look up at the board. There's a menu of prices for the services that they provide. It's pretty much just like going to a grocery store where you see what the prices are for fruit and other items. The reason that it works that way at a walk-in clinic is that a large part of their business is on a self-pay basis. It's entirely self-pay or significantly self-pay. So when the consumer, the patient, is the person to whom the economic interest of the provider is directed, then they come up with things that are transparent. So, for example, there's also, we showed in our talk, the website maintained by the Surgery Center of Oklahoma, which performs complex medical procedures and does so on a cash basis. It doesn't deal with insurance companies. It deals with individuals or with employers who send their employees there. You go to the Surgery Center's website, it's got a picture of a human body on it. You click on a body part, and it tells you how much it costs to do something to that body part. So you click on the hip, it says hip replacement. You click on that, and it says, here's the price for hip replacement surgery. It's right there. So when the consumer is spending money directly, the healthcare businesses operate just like other businesses. And so what we really are trying to spread the message of is self-pay. It has to be a big part of the reform. I don't think that legislating transparency is going to get you anywhere. It's got to come from the desire of the providers to get business by advertising their prices the same way it does everywhere else. I'm sure David wants to jump on this.
So this is Professor Hyman. Thank you for the question as well, Senator Costello, through the chair. The only things I would add are several quick points. First is, everywhere else in the economy, people voluntarily disclose their prices without any statutory mandate. And so it's worth asking yourself, why is it that this sector of the economy continues to make it very hard for people to figure out prices and for the people that work in the system to have no idea of what the charges will be? It's broader than simply, I don't know which insurance you have. There's a sort of broader, my job is to deliver health care, and the billing people handle that kind of issue. The second point is, if you go into any pharmacy in the state of Alaska, you will discover that the things in front of the prescription counter all have a single price, and it's low. And the things that are behind the counter, it's hard to figure out the price because it depends on the type of insurance and PBM coverage you have, and it's often quite high. It's not an accident that the presence of insurance is an important factor in the difference between the front and the back of the store. The last point I would make is that there could well be good reasons to do some transparency efforts, partly as a way of surfacing for everyone and making clear how public funds as well as private funds are being spent on significant differences by facilities and the cost of receiving particular kinds of treatments. But what you don't want is to compel them to disclose their charge masters, right, as they're called, because that's not a particularly useful or meaningful thing. What you want is for them to bundle the prices for particular types of problems. And I'd be happy to talk with you in more detail about that. The book talks a little bit about that, but we've also done other work on that subject.
If I can, this is Charlie Silver, I can make one more comment on that. That as a state budgetary matter, I believe that the problem is that the amount you have to spend on Medicaid is driven by the amount that the providers demand for treating Medicaid recipients. And what you need to do is to divorce yourself from that dependency. And we have some thoughts on how you can do that that consist mainly of creating a system in which there is catastrophic care insurance, so it provides an umbrella or a safety net, you might say, for people who suffer real catastrophes, which is what insurance is really designed to do. It's designed to deal with low-frequency, high-cost events, and then change the rest of the system to self-pay. So it should operate like food stamps or like Social Security or like the Earned Income Tax Credit. There are lots of programs that give people money, either with restrictions or without, with restrictions in the case of food stamps, without in the case of Social Security and the Earned Income Tax Credit. Those things funnel money into the hands of consumers who then use them to buy the things they need. The studies of the Earned Income Tax Credit, for example, show that the people who receive that, who are generally speaking low income, spend it on the sorts of things that you would think: housing, food, gasoline, car repairs, education. They spend the money reasonably well, and they also spend it on things other than healthcare that contribute very importantly to health. People don't really understand this, but most of the contribution to human health is not made by the healthcare system. It's made by things like access to clean water and stable housing instead of housing instability. Education is a huge driver of health as well. And poor people spend their money on these other things, which are called the social determinants of health. And they get a lot of bang for the buck. When you're spending money on intensive medical treatments, by comparison, you don't get nearly the payoff that you do from these other things.
And I should also note there are also, Professor Hyman, there are often positive spillovers for other members of the family when the money is spent on the social determinants of health. So it's not just limited to the particular individual who you're now giving the subsidy to directly, rather than being a passive payer of the bills that you receive from the healthcare system.
So is there it doesn't look like there's any other, Senator Bishop.
What's our timeline?
Well, we're going to do just a couple more minutes. This is an important topic, so I know we're running over, but
where did we go wrong in the United States with our health care? And where I'm going with this is my mother has her bill from when she was born in 1933. It was on a carbon triplicate on one page, and there was three lines, and it was $25 for 5 days in the hospital.
Seriously?
So where did we go wrong?
This is Professor Hyman. I would identify, you can set the starting point at various times depending upon whether you want to look at the federal level or the state level and whether how many things you can say are included. An important starting point was a decision around World War II to allow employment-based health insurance to be provided on a pre-tax basis. This is a very large subsidy for people to receive quite rich health insurance through the place of employment. It's also an important source of horizontal and vertical inequity. Horizontal because if your employer doesn't provide insurance, you don't get the subsidy. Vertical because of we have a progressive tax system, the subsidy is worth more to people who get paid more. And both of those are problems. But I think the basic issue is if you think we're spending too much on health care, maybe you should stop subsidizing health insurance, which is what we do. And it's the single largest tax subsidy. The second important inflection point was the adoption of Medicare and Medicaid in the form that they took. The empirical evidence is quite clear that the mid-1960s decision to structure Medicare and Medicaid on a tell-us-what-the-charges-are-and-we'll-pay-them approach was an invitation for both volume and price effects. And you can basically see an inflection point in our spending that has continued ever since. And I can show you, you know, cartoons and editorials that were written starting in the late 1960s saying, this is unsustainable. We have to figure out a way to cut this. And every couple of years, we have a similar flurry of articles. Each time the number that we're at goes up, but the same theme is sounded over and over again. I guess the last point I would make is state decisions, because the ones that I talked about so far are federal, although Medicaid is jointly administered. State decisions on supply issues, like certificate of need, like licensure and scope of authority, have an impact on the price and potentially the volume issues as well. So there's multiple factors that have all collided. So that it's now the stays in the hospital after you give birth are much shorter, but the bills are much, much higher.
That's right.
Just a brief follow-up, ma'am.
Please. You know,
so two quick ones. Alaska's Achilles heel, in my opinion, is the economy of scale, and you touched on that. We just don't have the population, so we can't bring more competition in. It's hard to bring competition in because where are you going to get the clients, right? There's only so many of us. The second thing is I'll agree with in your comments is I think, me personally, the only way you're going to change healthcare is if people just got to bow up and quit paying these premiums every year, these increases. It's ridiculous. My wages don't go up 17% every year, but my premium just went up 17% annually.
Well, at some point, I'm sorry, Charlie Silver from Texas. Thank you for the question, Senator Bishop, through the chair. At some point, people are forced to stop paying for the premiums, and they opt out. When those people go bare, they wind up looking for health care and become part of the army of people who are trying to use retail outlets. So there is a sort of silver lining to that cloud. The cost spiral cannot continue indefinitely. In other words, medical prices keep rising, keep driving up insurance prices. When people buy insurance, that encourages them to consume, which drives up prices, and we get this spiral. It can't go on indefinitely because premiums become unaffordable, and you're absolutely right. Healthcare costs have sucked up all of the real increase in American salaries over the past decade. It's really quite astonishing. So that spiral will end, there's going to be a lot of pain. And the question is, how does the pain get dealt with? We think Alaska has problems because you are geographically isolated and a lot of you have low-density populations. So you have difficulties that are going to be hard to overcome. But that just means that you really need to be more and more receptive, especially receptive to possibilities for market entry. So, for example, we have telehealth that reaches out, and I gather Alaska is pretty open to telehealth. The possibility of mobile healthcare centers. I don't know if you're familiar with those, but they're starting to come on because there are lots of towns, for example, in my home state of Texas, that can't support a full-time physician's office. And so what's happening is that there are developments of mobile medical centers that will serve on a route, and they are staffed by nurse practitioners or physician assistants or something of that sort. And that's better than nothing, right? In the end, though, you are going to have some situations that are very hard to solve, but you ought to solve the ones you can, right? And that'll put pressure on providers to charge less.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, and I think we've got everybody on the committee. I'm going to take a few minutes now. I have a career before this. I was chief operating officer of a large clinic in Anchorage Medical Park Family Care, and I also was assistant business office manager in a hospital in Texas, so your home state. And then also I spent about 10 years in the pharmaceutical industry, including being a manager, and I did biotech as well. So I am familiar, and I did years of billing as well. I started in a file room in high school. So I do have a lot of opinions in regards to healthcare. I wish now we would have actually booked you longer, but we've actually been almost 30 minutes. But there's some things, and I don't know if you have time to respond right now, but I'm going to do kind of just a list of things that are on my mind, and then maybe we can swing back around and you can meet me in the office or something like that. But what I'm worried about, $2,000 a month each of the state pays for us for our premium. It's, to me, outrageous. I think there's some serious negotiating issues, and that's why I want contracts negotiated in public, because I think $2,000 a month is an awful lot. I know my husband personally got off of it, you know, that, and we have the lowest you can get, but because we couldn't have a health savings account if he was on my insurance. So he's not on my insurance. We still pay this, you know, the state pays this crazy amount of premium. And just so we can have a health savings account, because I'm hugely into preventative care. I think if we don't focus on prevention, and that's why I think we need a lot of research done, why is cancer so doggone high in this state? It's been a passion of mine for years. We have more cancer than we do heart disease. So we could drill down, you know, on why. All over Alaska, we have huge problems with cancer. I would love to do research in regards to that. I was able to place one research grant here and start a lipid clinic in Alaska with my former company. But that heart disease is one, but I think cancer is also another huge one. Also, sexual assault and domestic violence are really driving up costs, because they show in ACEs, you know, the adverse child experience, they can be $1 million or so. The kid, that it can cost them in healthcare costs. So I really think we need to focus in regards to that. Hospital audits. I know when I go to the hospital, which is almost never, I audit my bills. I know there's an auditor in every single hospital, and I make sure that every bill and, you know, everything is audited. And everybody has that right, by the way, to get your hospital. There's an hospital auditor that can do that. I think you're right about third-party insurance. That's outrageous. It's driving the cost up. They take so little risk, and yet the doctors are taking all the risk, so I take a little different in regards to this. But the insurance companies, you should look at the salaries. I posted the salaries of the large healthcare insurers. It's outrageous, the salaries of the insurance companies. It is unbelievable. It was on Facebook, people are just astonished. Tort reform, I think, is critical. We absolutely need to get tort reform. You guys can comment on any of this if you want. But ER, overly utilization of the emergency room. I did, in one high-profile person I talked to said 10% of the patients are 90% utilization. So there's a certain percentage of the population that are driving up the costs for everybody. I'm sure you guys are familiar with that. Of course, pharmaceuticals, we need to, you know, look into that. But a doctor showed me an app where in Alaska, there's this app, and you can reduce your costs. They show the cost of the pharmaceutical on every single pharmacy in Alaska and where the cheapest place to buy is. So we used to go and do research, you know, when it's in pharma, and tell them where the cheapest place to buy pharmaceuticals is. But I could go on and on and on, but I do think that competition is absolutely critical. Whatever base we have, we've got to bring in, you know, we've got to bring in, break down the barriers for competition. If you want to comment on that, feel free. But I tried to let everyone else talk first, and I know I took a couple minutes, but anyway, feel free.
So thank you for the question, Senator Reinbold. Let me address just a couple of them, and we'd be happy to meet with you separately at your convenience, and happy to come back to talk to you about it more. Having visited your beautiful state for all of a day, I would very much like to come back. Emergency departments are important, critical parts of our healthcare system, but they're also plagued by overutilization, problems that are seen in the emergency department that don't need to be treated there, and problems that are social problems that come to the emergency department that the so-called frequent flyers utilizers are often people who have housing instability issues and encounters with the criminal justice system and substance abuse problems and so on. Emergency departments are not great places for addressing those problems, but often by default they are the place that ends up dealing with them. We ought to be thinking creatively about ways of getting those sorts of problems out of emergency departments into a more appropriate venue, because emergency departments, the last point is, they're very expensive places to treat these problems. Very high bills, often out of network for the people that have insurance, and many people don't have insurance. And so that is, I think, an important challenge that you ought to attack, not on the financing side, but on the delivery side. Second, tort reform, we're law professors, and so we actually have devoted a lot of effort to studying the medical malpractice system. I'd be happy to share with you some of the articles we've done. I think the consensus is that tort reform among the states that have done it has had at best a modest effect on levels and trends in healthcare spending. There may be other reasons for doing tort reform, but there is clearly defensive medicine out there, but tort reform does not appear to be a particularly effective way of addressing the defensive medicine that all physicians insist accounts for a significant chunk of their clinical decision making. And I'd be happy to share with you the articles, both that we've done and that other people have done, that suggest the impact of tort reform is relatively modest. And that, I think, is a disappointment to the people who viewed this as a silver bullet. But the huge numbers that you hear are not borne out by the empirical research. There are certainly anecdotal evidence. I think the broader point that we want to signal to you is that being a passive payer of the bills is not an effective strategy. And the reason why you're looking at, you know, premiums of several thousand dollars a month, which, by the way, most patients and most employed individuals have no idea that that's the cost of the coverage. They see that they're not getting a raise. What they don't realize is that the raise they would have gotten has vanished into the increased costs that are being spent by their employer to provide health coverage to them. Whether people would behave the same way if they actually had to write a check every month for $2,000 out of their after-tax income, I think we would see a very different set of trade-offs being made by people. And so coupling insurance to employment, although it solves one set of problems, has actually created another. Most people don't actually understand how expensive their coverage truly is. So let me stop there.
Okay, and with that, I'm the chair, so I get the final word. I do think there's a healthy and unhealthy tension between lawyers, and a lot of doctors believe that they're micromanaged, overregulated, told what medications they can and cannot use. They waste all their time on the phone fighting insurance companies. But lawyers are completely and totally unregulated and can charge whatever the heck they want. So we can have a healthy debate about this, but I can tell you I do think lawyers are part of the problem with this whole healthcare problem as well. I mean, and that's absolutely no offense at all to you guys. I think you're trying. You're really, really trying. I look forward to getting Cliff Notes, you know, in regards to the bill or on your book. I think that would be fantastic. I'd be happy to meet with you. And if it's the will of this committee, maybe next year we can have just a much, much more in-depth. We've got some pretty big things already on the calendar the rest of this year, but possibly if it's the will of this committee, then we can have a much broader discussion next year in regards to this. But, gentlemen, thank you for being with us, and thank you for
so
your
much.
Hard work.
Thank you for listening to us. Appreciate it.
Commissioner Ledbetter?
Kind word.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Burke.
I just wanted to apologize for, I had an Education Finance Committee meeting, and I had the good fortune of actually seeing this program at the Lunch and Learn today, and it was very inspiring, and I appreciate you having them here for the committee today.
Excellent, well. Senator Burke, and I'm sorry that I forgot to recognize you. We were pretty intensely involved in that discussion. A welcome, and thank you. Your staff did let me know you were going to be late, so I really, really appreciate it, and I'm really super happy you got to do that Lunch and Learn today. So with that, we're super excited to have Senate Bill 65 before us, Department of Labor Technical Ed Programs. And Commissioner Designee, please put your name on the record and proceed.
Thank you. Dr. Tamika Ledbetter, for the record, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Thank you, Madam Chair. So good afternoon to Senator Reinbold and the members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here and to present for your consideration Senate Bill 65. And also thank you to the team from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. They're here with me today, both deputy commissioners, special assistant, and some of our division directors and those that are on the phone. At the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, connecting Alaskans to the job opportunities in our state is a primary focus of our work. Our goal is to reach more young Alaskans and to connect them with training that leads to family wage job opportunities in their home regions. Whether those individuals live in coastal Alaska or the interior, we are working to identify partnerships with employers and training organizations that will best prepare Alaskans for these opportunities. And so Senate Bill 65 adds language in Title 44, directing the Department of Labor and Workforce Development to coordinate and monitor state career and technical education programs. This will be accomplished in collaboration with the Department of Education and Early Development, the University of Alaska, and other entities that provide career and technical training. The Department of Labor and Workforce Development works to provide job seekers and workers with high-quality training, education, and career services. This is a central focus of our mission. The department also helps employers find skilled workers and identifies education and training opportunities for their current workforce. The Alaska Workforce Investment Board, otherwise known as the AWIB, located in the commissioner's office, is the lead state planning and coordinating entity for human resource programs in the state. Members represent a diverse cross-section of businesses and educational partners. In 2010, the AWIB worked in cooperation with the Department of Education and Early Development and the University of Alaska to develop the 2010 Alaska Career and Technical Education, or CTE, plan, which called for strategies to improve career and technical education and prepare Alaskans with required skills needed for post-secondary training and careers in high-growth occupations in Alaska. The CTE plan called for increasing efforts to develop career pathways, career counseling, standards for training programs, coordination, and program delivery. The plan addressed the individual need for career preparedness as well as the broader need for a training and education system that is efficient, effective, and coordinated with current and future workforce needs. In 2018, these same partners developed the 2018 addendum to the Alaska Career and Technical Education Plan to re-energize the conversation around CTE, to re-examine CTE plan strategies, and to help ensure that our broad spectrum of education and training opportunities are communicated to Alaskans. A CTE coordinator works to implement that CTE plan strategy or those strategies. AVTEC, also known as the Alaska Vocational Technical Education Center, is the premier state training school for customized trainings directed at specific employers and longer-term trainings averaging 9 months in duration in maritime, applied technology, the culinary arts, energy, and building technology and information technology. Another key role that the Department of Labor plays is in the dissemination of career and technical education or technical training funds through STEP, which is State Training and Employment Program Funds, TVEP, and many federal grant programs. So Senate Bill 65 formalizes the role of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development as the lead agency in coordinating and monitoring state career and technical education. And so I would just like to thank you for allowing me to present that, and I appreciate the support of this legislation.
Absolutely. And it's a two-page bill, so that's why I let the other go just a little late. So I just wanted to say thank you for your patience, because that health care issue is a really, really hot button. So with that, Senator Birch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say how remarkable it is to witness the level of engagement and the positive impact that continuing technical education has on on our children. And specifically, we had heard from the superintendent of the Juneau School District, and as I recall, there was around 82% graduation rate at 4 years, and in their high schools, and I think it bumped up to like 84% a couple points after 5 years, you know, kids that had to get a few extra courses. Remarkably, the graduation rate for students when they had a continuing technical education component in their curriculum bumped up to, like, I want to say 93 or 94% here in Juneau, wow, which I just think is astounding. And I think I'm very pleased to see the your engagement and this proposal to you know, basically plug into the schools in the early education just all the way through. I think it's a real positive move, and I very much appreciate you bringing this forward, and thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Excellent input. Thank you. Anybody else?
I have a comment. Senator Costello. Thank you, and it's encouraging to see that we're trying to break down some silos between the Department of Labor and the Department of Education. Those are two departments that I thought really should work in tandem, because one is getting kids ready for the working world, and the other is also training for the working world. So I see that as a natural link, so I appreciate the legislation. My question is, do you feel that the language goes far enough in terms of just mentioning the Department of Education? Because what I would like to see is this actually reach down into the high school level or even middle school and look at the programs, for example, that we have in the Anchorage School District for career and technical opportunities that are happening right now. And I would not want to miss out on that just simply by assuming that when you put Department of Education here, that you mean that you'll actually be working with schools, or do we need to actually mention that that's the intention of the legislation?
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Costello, for the question. And I just want to mention that we do have Executive Director Louise Dean on the line if there are further questions. As far as I look at the language, I think it's good the way it is. As when I look at career and technical education, it does not stop at K through 12 for me. It's a robust strategy. It's a robust plan to address all career and technical education at every level from, you know, kindergarten on up to age 99, if that's possible. We want to make sure that Department of Labor is involved at every level when it comes to the coordination and the monitoring of CTE. If you have a career and technical education plan that does not end with employment in mind, it's a failed plan. And so we really believe that we need to be not only seated at the table, but leading the way, because we are the ones that have the employer community. That's our primary customer as far as the Department of Labor is concerned. And as we assess their training and employment and workforce needs, we want to ensure that coordination with not only education, but with the university system, to ensure that we're training and educating young people and older people to be able to occupy those positions that are now vacant and those positions that we would also like to bring to Alaska.
A follow-up?
Absolutely.
So, Commissioner, thank you for that. So where do local school districts fall into this this new language that's being introduced?
Through the chair, again, I would say that the coordination and monitoring, we have our CTE coordinator that is on board, and the specific role of that position is to reach out to all schools, to reach out to private industry, to reach out to the university system, to ensure that we have a plan as we move forward to encourage the school system to recognize that young people may not know what they want to be when they grow up, but certainly by fifth grade, they know exactly what they don't want to be. And so we encourage them to work with us. We encourage them to see this as a wonderful opportunity to partner with the Department of Labor, to realize that our coordination and our monitor of CTE is not a hostile takeover, but it's something that needs to happen if we're going to grow the workforce in Alaska.
And do you have information on what jobs will be needed in the coming decades? I know that the department, when it came to the gas line, we were waiting
for that plan, that plan that basically said, you know, these are the types of careers that we'll be needing. Is the department updating regularly what those jobs are, and can you share that with the committee?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, we always look at those jobs that are forthcoming, those jobs that we believe will be needed in the future. We have a wonderful research and analysis group that can work on getting a specific answer to you.
Final question, please. When the Commissioner of Education came before the Senate Education Committee, I asked him about the role of coding in future jobs for Alaskans, and he was very excited. I mean, apparently that's one of his priorities. Do you happen to know in your future job projections, are coding jobs something that the department is looking at?
Thank you for that question. Through the chair, we actually have worked very closely with the Commissioner of Education on those coding academies. We held two events so far, one in Kotzebue, very well received there. We held one in Mat-Su, very well received there. And coding is one of those high-tech industries that we will see a lot of in Alaska. We are positioned right now, our placement geographically allows us to be poised for a lot of different opportunities that we haven't tapped into previously. And so we have younger people excited now about coding. We've pitched that all Alaskans can code, and we have an event that is coming up on Thursday. And so if each of the committee members have an opportunity to attend that Juno kickoff event, I think you'll be pleasantly surprised at the interest level that there is in coding and the opportunities for the future.
If they could get details to the committee, that would be great.
Excellent. That's exactly what I was just going to say. Do you have them with you?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, please?
Yes.
Kat, Representative Enos, do you want to come on up? Kathy? Please proceed. Just make sure you state your name for the recorders. They have a tough job, so I wouldn't want their job.
It's Dr. Tamika Ledbetter approaching the chair.
Okay. Do you want to introduce this, or do you want me to read this?
Yes, ma'am. You can read it if
okay,
that's correct.
Okay. I'll read it. Do you want to read it? Okay. Senator Bishop has a comment first.
So thanks for coming today. What are you going to do with – when you come back – I think you might be coming back later this week.
Thursday.
I don't want to get ahead of the chair. But can you bring us back some benchmarks, what you're going to do with this information? What are the benchmarks, say, for an underperforming school district? You know, what's the guidelines? What's the benchmarks that you and the university and Department of Education – I don't know if you've – had time to flesh that out yet. If you could bring that back Thursday and share that with us, because at the end of the day, what's the deliverables that you want to accomplish here, right? Because I could go for an hour and not come up for oxygen on this one paragraph right here, but I'll just leave it at this. We don't spend enough money in this state in our school districts for career and technical education, period.
I agree. But anyway, Commissioner Ledbetter, did you want to make a comment?
I would just like to say, Madam Chair, that, you know, we have language already written out in our plan under the Alaska Workforce Investment Board. We have already stepped up as a leader in career and technical education. This proposal just strengthens that role, and I'm excited about it. Career and technical education is one of my primary focuses. The governor of Alaska is interested in ensuring that youth all across the state have opportunities as well. I think that having one of the duties of the Department of Labor to coordinate and monitor is going to not only allow us to bring a richness to career and technical education, it will allow us to communicate that CTE is more than just having a CTE class in a school. It's more than just hiring a CTE instructor. It's more than just, you know, having a separate program that's titled CTE. It really has to be embedded throughout everything that we do. We have to know that whatever training we provide, whatever education we provide, If the goal is not a good paying job at the end of that, then why are we educating and why are we training? And so I just wanted to leave you all with that, that I think that this is more of an overall investment. And I believe that we will see benchmarks. I believe we will see a higher quality, qualified population that's able to go into the jobs that are now available. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to make a quick comment before Senator Costello announces when this excellent coding seminar is. But I took drafting in high school, and I also took woodworking, and I took auto. It was three of the best classes by far, and it just made me sick when some of the schools took out their woodworking or their auto and used them as storage rooms. I thought it was the stupidest thing. I've been fighting this for like 15, 20 years. My boys didn't have the opportunity because, you know, Eagle River High, they stripped down the only out of curricula. We don't even have a theater at that school. So they have virtually nothing at that school. The only thing my son could do is take pottery, which is not exactly what a football player wanted to do, but it was the only option. He ended up making some beautiful pottery. Thank goodness a few pieces didn't get broken in the earthquake, but most of it got broken in the earthquake, but I treasure those. But anyway, I'm a huge believer in this automotive. He ended up becoming a mechanical engineer, and it's just a darn shame that they don't have some of these really important things right in our high school, because they have to drive all the way to Crane Career Center from Eagle River on the icy road. So I'm a huge believer. I don't care if it's Chugiak. I don't care if it's Eagle River High, but any high school, any technical, a lot of boys have a really tough time. They don't really care about Alaska history or new math or whatever. You know, they really need hands-on, and it helps get them so they can transition into life after school. And so I'm just a huge believer. So anyway, completely agree with you, Senator Birch. And okay. If you don't mind, Senator Costello.
So, Madam Chair, it looks like we might be taking a field trip next Thursday or this Thursday, stopping the committee early. Apparently, the coding session is from noon to 4 at the Alaska State Museum, and it's for anybody to participate, even if you've never done it before. So it's a hands-on experience, and there will be industry leaders there, too. So thank you for that, Commissioner.
Excellent. So I'm going to just put you on the spot. We still have 7 more minutes for this bill. So I do want to open and close public testimony. If you want to announce anybody else in the room, please feel free to do that. And I also want to put you on the spot and see, are you going to be here on Thursday, or can you be here on Thursday?
I will be here with you on Thursday.
Okay, excellent. Okay. And with that, did you want to announce anybody? I see several people like Paloma Harbor. I don't know if I should or if you should go ahead and announce who's in the room.
We have in the room with us, we have Deputy Commissioner Kathy Munoz. We have Deputy Commissioner Nelson San Juan. We have ASD Director with Labor, Paloma Harbor. We have Special Assistant Jerry Pierce. We also have Director Gray Mitchell, who is the Director of Workers' Compensation. We have our CTE Coordinator, Greg Cashin. On the phone, I believe we have Executive Director of the AWIB, Louise Dean, and we have Dan Rapaski, who is with us from AvTech.
Excellent. That's what I needed to do so I could clear up my screen. And I love it when you guys raise your hand out there, too, because she had a much bigger list than I had. So thank you very much. With that, I'm going to go ahead and open and close public testimony at this time, since we still have 6 minutes on this bill, and then I'll let anybody make comments, and I'll tell you what the plans are for the bill. But I'm going to go to open public testimony. Now I don't see anybody online because you named them all, and it says questions here. Is there anybody in the room that would like to testify on this bill? Are you sure? A lot of people in this room. Okay. Well, I don't see anybody online, so I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. And I'm going to tell let the members know that our intention is to have amendments due by 6 o'clock tomorrow night. If you could work with the sponsors of the bill, that always helps make everything easier and fit together a lot better. And then, if it's the will of the committee, I'd like to move this bill out on Thursday. So I just want to let everybody know. If anyone has any other comments, we still have a few minutes on this bill today, or you can speak on Thursday. Looks like. Okay, it looks like we're going to finish up just a few minutes early. So with that, thank you very much for coming today, and we will see you back here, and we'll have you first up on Thursday in case you need to get here, okay? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I don't think Julie Heskett has come on yet.
Did you close it?
I did close it.
Okay, we're going to take a 2-minute at ease. So we are gaveled back in, and I apologize. That was a little bit longer at ease than what I had anticipated because we were waiting for Julie Duquette to call in before we started our next presentation. So, Julie, we know you're a reappointee to this board. So if you could, I know you're on a really tight schedule, so as promised, we're going to have you right here at 2:30. If you could please state your name, affiliation, and why you would like to be reappointed to this board.
Hi, thank you. My name is Julie Duquette, and I work at Sladen Plumbing and Heating. I've been in the construction industry my whole life and support industry, working with various companies. I have a big interest in safety and assuring our employees are have a safe environment and working atmosphere, and they go home at the same they came to work in the morning, and I just think it's part of our duty to work in some of the committees and help on some of the boards to further Alaska and the construction industry.
Excellent. I'm going to see Senator Birch has a question for you, Julie.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I just it's good to hear your voice, Julie. I just wanted to thank you for your interest in continuing to serve in this capacity. It's always helpful to have good, knowledgeable folks with a good grasp of the business and the industry, and I'm thrilled to see you're interested in re-upping.
Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. Senator Bishop.
Hey, good afternoon, Julie.
Good afternoon.
And I just want to echo Senator Birch's comments. So I'm glad to see that you're stepping into the breach again and re-upping. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, Julie, you got a great reputation. So I'm going to go ahead and open and close public testimony. I don't think we have anybody testifying. It's just part of the formal process. So if you can hold on, and then if you have any closing comments, that'd be great. Okay, so hold on. Open public testimony. Would anybody in the room like to testify? Not even you? Don, are you sure? He knows I'm looking at him. Okay, I do not see anybody online, so I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. With that, Julie, do you have any closing comments?
No, thank you guys very much, and I appreciate all the hard work you do.
Okay, Julie, well, I'm going to just say we have a couple workers' compensation bills coming down the chute here, and we're probably going to be taking those up before too long. So if you could just keep an eye and make sure, you if you have any input on them, please contact me or any member on this committee. And we really need to do anything we can to reduce the number of injuries out there and also to bring the costs down of the way too high with workers' compensation insurance right now. So anyway, thank you for your willingness to serve, and we wish you the best.
Thank you very much.
Okay, and with that, I think the... Oh, do you want me to do that right now? Okay, well, we can go ahead and do that. We can go ahead and do that right now. Okay, so in accordance with the AS 3905080, Labor and Commerce Committee reviewed the following recommendations. The appointee be forwarded to the joint session for consideration to the Workers' Compensation Board, Julie Duquette. This does not reflect an intent for any members to vote for or against the confirmation during any further sessions. So we're going to go ahead. While the department comes up, we're going to sign paperwork. So please come forth. traveling right back in today, and thanks, everybody. Today, we have the next bill up. So we have Senate Bill 66, Labor Standards, Safety, and Workers' Comp. Can we please proceed? As normal, at least there's two different people here, so the recorder will have an easier job, but please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, again, thank you to the committee for hearing Senate Bill 66. This is Dr. Tamika Ledbetter for the record. This bill proposes to merge the Workers' Compensation and Labor Standards and Safety divisions. The Division of Labor Standards and Safety is focused on preventing workplace accidents and enforcing laws related to workplace safety and wages, while the Division of Workers' Compensation is focused on the efficient administration of benefits to injured workers and enforcing laws related to workers' compensation requirements. The missions of these two divisions complement each other in that one works to prevent accidents and the other works to provide an efficient system of benefits for injured workers. The divisions have historically worked together, and this bill is expected to further increase the opportunities to remove silos and capitalize on efficiencies through a unified management structure. The department is cognizant of the critical roles that each of these divisions have, and the proposed merger does not impact any of the statutes or regulations currently administered and enforced by each division. The merger aims to take advantage of position vacancies to explore opportunities to share duties between divisions where it makes sense, streamline processes, and cut back on unnecessary middle management supervisory functions. As reflected in the fiscal note, the bill flattens the management structure in labor standards and safety by reclassifying the director to a deputy director who will focus attention on operational aspects of the new division's inspection, consultation, and enforcement functions. This will allow for a mid-level management reduction in the ACOSH, or Alaska Occupational Safety and Health component. In addition, the fiscal note illustrates the opportunity to consolidate and share administrative duties between the two divisions where it makes sense. Future opportunities for increased efficiency could come from office space consolidations to increase opportunities for coordination and improve service delivery for employers and workers. This effort is not expected to happen overnight, but will be carefully developed over time. The bill does not propose to change the functions of the Division of Labor Standards and Safety or the Division of Workers' Compensation. It's all about establishing a structure that creates maximum opportunities to share resources and get the work done more efficiently. And so here with me today to provide the sectional analysis for this bill is Director Gray Mitchell.
Good afternoon. My name is Gray Mitchell. I'm the Director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. As stated by Commissioner Ledbetter, the main purpose of Senate Bill 66 is to combine the Division of Workers' Compensation with the Division of Labor Standards and Safety. I'm going to walk you through the bill section by section. Just to sort of streamline the process, I wanted to point out that Section 1 through 6 are purely name change adjustments from the Labor Standards and Safety Division to the new Workers' Safety and Compensation Division. So Section 1 is on page 1, lines 5 through 10, and you'll notice the change at lines 7 and 8 of page 1, simply a change from Labor Standards and Safety to Workers' Safety and Compensation. Section 2, same type of change. That section is from line 11 on page 1 to line 9 on page 2. And the change appears on page 1 at line 12 and 13. Section 3, same kind of change. That section is on page 2, lines 10 through 19. And you'll see the change at page 2, line 11 through 14, which again is just the name change. Section 4, same thing. Page 2, line 20 through page 3, line 6, and that change is specifically located at page 2, line 24 to 25. Again, just a name change. Section 5 is on page 3, line 7 through 17. You'll see the specific change at page 3, line 13 to 14. Again, just the name change. Section 6 is page 3, line 18 to page 4, line 4. The specific change is on page 3 at line 29. Is this going okay, or am I being too monotonous?
I already read the bill, so I'm good. I don't know if everyone else is good.
I got it.
I think everyone's good.
Okay. Skip ahead.
All right.
Do we have questions then?
Madam Chair, just so you know, we do have Deputy Director Tari Gales on the line as well for questions.
Senator Costello.
Thank you. And, you know, my question is just, is there any opposition that you know of to this change? And then does the change of the name with the removal of the word standard, will that have any effect at all as far as the standard and safety division?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Costello, the name change does not impact any of the statutory authorities under the new divisions. So all of the previous authorities that were either under workers' comp or under labor standards and safety would be incorporated under this new division of worker safety and compensation. But all of the authorities are the same in terms of, you know, there's still standards that the new division would enforce under wage and hour and mechanical inspection. Those programs would continue under the merged division just as they are today under the separate divisions.
And my question about, is there any opposition that you're aware of?
Sorry, through the chair. Two-part questions. No, we don't. We haven't heard any opposition to the proposed merger at this point.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you. I wasn't worried until you asked the two-part question, and now we're putting them to, no. So you'll absorb all the cost to change all the letterhead and printing in the offices and changing all the elevator certificates, and that'll all be absorbed in the department?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Thank you. And a follow-up question. So, Mr. Mitchell, I know you. So will you and the commissioner be the first ones to come tell us if this isn't working?
Through the chair, yes, we will. And so as I said, this is, or actually the commissioner pointed this out in her points, this is a process. Mm-hmm. We don't know exactly all of the details that we're going to be faced with as we merge these two divisions together. And if for some reason there's an issue later that requires us to beef up services in some area or another to maintain the same level of service that we have now, then we'll do that. We do not intend to reduce services to the public as a result of the merger, and our goal is actually to increase the availability of service. Currently, and for example, an employer today might see a workers' comp investigator show up on their site, and then a couple days later, a wage and hour investigator might show up. With a little bit of coordination, we're hopeful that we can increase the efficiency that we handle those tasks with, and moving forward, produce a better product for the public.
Thank you.
Senator Burch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, mindful of there's been a lot of discussion about Boeing and the FAA and who, you know, who's regulated and who's monitoring the regulators. And I guess I'm not that familiar with, you know, what exactly is accomplished under labor safety and standards versus workers' compensation. Is there any sort of tension between the two, or is there, is you know, I mean, you got worker safety and then you got workers' compensation, which obviously is going to be, the less safe environment, presumably, the more workers' compensation claims you're going to have. So, I mean, I'm just not familiar enough with what those two organizations do. But, you know, when you merge them, obviously they're more closely aligned. And I was just wondering if you could speak to that through the chair.
Thanks. Through the chair, Senator Birch, we don't see any conflict between the Division of Labor Standards and Safety or Division of Workers' Compensation. And in fact, we believe that there's some synergy there where one division is currently focused on reducing accidents, dealing with safety hazards, and then the other division currently focuses on paying benefits when there is an incident. And so sharing data between those two divisions and providing administrative oversight between those two divisions just makes sense.
Okay. And may I just add, through the chair, Senator Birch, you know, we are the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Mm-hmm. And so this is an opportunity for us to pretty much practice what we preach in that way. We have a division director at this point over workers' compensation who previously spent time as a director over labor standards and safety. And so we have a wonderful opportunity for knowledge sharing. We have an opportunity to ensure that we're passing information down to the next generation, so to speak. And we have our deputy director, Tariq Gales, over labor standards and safety. He's got 10 years of experience in that field. And so we have, you know, this opportunity for collaboration and the sharing of knowledge and just to build a rich division that will really be two halves of the same whole. And so I'm excited for the opportunity to proceed with a merger, and we've already begun that process of collaboration and coordination.
Fair enough. Thank you for the clarification. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, so Dr. Ledbetter, I'm going to take a question from Senator Gray Jackson. Then I do want to open and close public testimony, but after she speaks, I'm going to ask you to go over everybody that's here to help you versus who actually wants to testify. So just keep that in your mind. Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. I just want to thank Senator Costello for asking the question if there was any opposition. I think that's a real important question, and you said that there were was not correct. Okay, and I really love seeing efficiencies, and for starters, you're gonna save $238,000, mm-hmm. and then more to come, correct?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And it's 283.
83? Yeah. I said it backwards. Thank
yep,
you.
I do that all the time. That's why I caught you. Okay, so if you could, Dr. Ledbetter, if you could just tell us who all's here with you, that would be really helpful for me.
So today we have Director Gray Mitchell here. We have Deputy Director Tariq Gales on the line, and we have ASD Director Paloma Harbor here to discuss the fiscal note.
Okay, and I'm going to mention there's several other people here. So I'm going to go ahead and open public testimony because I think we still have 10 minutes left. So I'm going to go ahead and open public testimony. And if you don't want to testify, just shake your head. I have Charles, S-T-E-V-E-R. Is Charles in the room? Speak now, forever hold your peace, Charles. Okay, I also have a David Owens. I'm sorry, you don't want to testify? Okay, got it. We have Deputy Commissioner Munoz. No? Okay, this is going really fast. Gerald Price did not want to testify. Okay, that's why I wanted to go over all these with you guys. Okay, Greg Cashin, you didn't want to testify? Okay. I was trying to avoid that. Okay, well, I just want to make sure. Nelson Juan?
Sam
Juan? Okay, you didn't want to. Okay, I just want to make sure I don't skip anybody that wants to testify. So now that I've got everybody online, I'm going to open if there's anybody in the room. Vinny? Nothing? Donnie? Nothing?
We'll be offering written testimony.
Oh, yay. Okay, good. I got him in the hot seat.
Finally.
Okay. Be nice.
Love you today. All good in the school kids
learning. That was great speech, too. I like that one. Don Etheridge with the Alaska AFL-CIO. The one concern that we do have with this, and I've seen it many times when we've merged divisions and departments, is that one gets left out and slips to the side somehow, and that's the one concern that I have over merging any of the departments or the divisions. And And I'm hoping that we can make sure that that don't happen.
Okay. Short and sweet. Thank you. That's how we like it in labor and commerce. Okay. Okay, good. Good. Anybody else in the room? Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. Okay, so with that, we're going to go ahead and bring the, do you all want to come back up? And if anybody in the committee, we've still got 5 minutes, if anyone wants to make any comments on this bill. Right now, I'm going to use the same deadline for amendments tomorrow night, 6 p.m. for this bill and the previous bill. So just so the committee members know. And I am flexible. If people, you know, really want to work on something and you need me to push the deadline a little bit, I'm happy to do that because I think it's really important to listen to the committee members. With that, Dr. Ledbetter, is there anything else you would like to say about this?
The only thing I would like to say, Madam Chair, is that, again, we have thought long and hard about this, and we're looking for ways to increase our effectiveness and demonstrate that we can find efficiencies. Again, I'm very concerned about staff, and I always like to ensure that anything that we do makes sense and that it does no harm to our workforce. And so I have no doubt that we're going to proceed with the merger in a way that is beneficial to all, and we will not leave anyone out.
Excellent. Okay, so just going to let committee members know, public testimony has been open and closed. Amendments for both bills are due tomorrow night at 6 o'clock. And we're going to plan on bringing these back up on Thursday. And we also have governor's appointees. We're almost done with all of them, you guys. I think my staff's been doing an amazing job, and we just have a few left. And so we believe we're going to be done with them this Thursday. So it was really important for us to get those out of committee. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and gavel out. It is 2:55 p.m.